Kings, and for the next few weeks, it's going to be going back and forth between the kings, a little confusing. The general pattern is, though the southern kingdom had a few good kings, the northern kingdom had no good kings. Someone has said, that's the way it's been in America, not just say the north and south with the Civil War, but did you know that one time the south was dominated almost entirely by Democrats? Because they say, well, it was a Republican, Lincoln, that started the war. But it began to change, because I grew up in the South. They talk about the solid South, overwhelmingly Democrat, and it changed gradually. And so now it's primarily conservative Republicans. But then the question has arisen, I've heard someone say, Israel North and South was kind of like America switching, where there have been a few good Republicans that uphold biblical standards, but how many Democrats? They're like the northern Israelites, perhaps. But things do change with the winds of time. So tonight we look at seven kings, and that's the title of the message. Some good, some bad, some from the north, some from the south. Okay, look at the last verse of 1 Corinthians 14. Rehoboam rested with his fathers, that's a way of saying he died, was buried with his fathers in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah, an Ammonitess. She was outside Israel from Ammon. And then Abijam, his son, reigned in his place. And some translations spell that name differently. So Rehoboam, who is not that good of a king, dies, and his son Abijam takes over, who would be the great-grandson of David. And you'll notice over and over again they compare these kings with David. David did that one great sin, but by and large he was a good, godly king. And so it says he was as good as David, or he wasn't like David. Now the usual custom then was that if a man was king and he died, his son took over. That's what's called a dynasty. That's what they still have over in the United Kingdom with England. And they'll give you a long list of who is next in line to the throne. Anybody want to take a guess? Good Queen Elizabeth is, 96 now. And when she dies, her eldest son will take over. And if he dies, it'll go to his son, not his sister. Some of y'all didn't know that there's the daughter, Anne. And then there's another brother, Andrew, and another one you never hear about, and you wonder who's going to take over. Well, America doesn't have a dynasty as such, except in the old days, the Kennedys and then the Bushes. But that wasn't quite the same thing. Anyway, back to the story here. Jeroboam up north wanted to interrupt that and say, it's not going to be the son of Solomon I'm taking over, and the war broke out. By custom, going back to the first king. Okay, class, someone shout out, who was the first king of Israel? No, that was a trick question. It was God. Remember, God was the first king, and when they said, we want a king like everybody else, God condescends, I'll give you Saul, but you'll be sorry. But God was the first king, but they didn't want that, and so that's started the gradual slide, but occasionally there'd be a good king like David. Much of Solomon, but not all, and then some later ones. So by custom, Saul's son would have been the king. Who was that? Jonathan. But he died in battle together with his father. And so it went to someone outside of the line of Saul. It went to a young man named David. And that started the dynasty. And God made a covenant with David saying, it'll be after you, your son, grandson, great-grandson. There will always be someone in your line that will be on the throne of Judah, even after this civil war. Then when David was about to die, there was a power struggle. Someone else wanted to be king instead of Solomon, and David said, no, it's Solomon. And then when Solomon was about to die, another son said, it's me. There's a power struggle and fighting and killing and assassination, very bloody. And unfortunately, that happens in another area more common than you may realize. When a man dies, often his heirs start fighting over the inheritance. They'll sue each other. And it's not just for the very wealthy. I mean, they can afford super expensive lawyers and they go to court because they're talking about tens of millions of dollars. But even in poor families, they'll fight over the television that Dad used to watch. So I always tell them, don't come to me. I've been asked to intervene. And I imitate Jesus. Remember, a man came to Jesus and said, Master, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Remember what Jesus said? He said, Mister, who made me a judge over you? If Jesus wouldn't get involved, when people ask me as a pastor, I say, honor the will and keep the peace in the family. And that's good advice. Well, here there's a power struggle like heirs fighting over the will. And in such times, the best and the worst comes out in people. I've noticed that. With the death of someone, or you see it here in Israel, the best and the worst comes out. Someone once said, Brother James, you'll like this, kind of an earthy illustration. They said, in such times, it's like cream and scum. They both rise to the top. The best and the worst tend to rise to the top in politics and in business and in the thrones, because Jeroboam and Rehoboam were the scum that rose to the top in the swamp. But then we'll find some good kings that later came that rose to the top, because God, you know, the principle there is that God can put someone in a power and he can take them out. We should pray that God puts good godly leaders in our society, not necessarily a king. By the way, there's another principle there. Better to have a good king than ungodly democracy. Because what really matters is the godliness, not whether it's a king or a democracy or a republic or any other form. Because look at David, he was a king. But then look at Israel, before there was a king, there were judges. And how does the book of Judges end? With a condemnation. There was no king in Israel. Everybody did what was right in his own sight. And so that was an extreme democracy that went to seed. It was terrible. And yet you had a king that was very godly later. Okay, so let's get back to the story here. Chapter 15, verse 2. Abijam reigned for 3 years, which would be less than the presidential term, except for two that died before their term ended. And what would be his epitaph? He walked in all the ways of his father David, and his heart was loyal to the Lord, as was the heart of David. Notice the word loyal. Loyal to the Lord. And that's what we should be. Good example from this man. He wasn't perfect, neither was David, but as a course of life, he stuck to God and was loyal, even with this civil war and ungodliness and paganism spreading. Now, later, kings north and south would be compared with David. Let's apply that today. If you are a godly Christian, how do you measure up with your ancestors? Were they godly? What about your descendants? Will they follow in your example or not? What about your children, grandchildren, the family line? Think about that. Those that came before us and those that come after us, just like we'll see tonight. Okay, verse 4, God honored his covenant with David to bless the royal Davidic line, but God made no such promise to the northern renegades that split the kingdom. God did not promise them. Consequently, they went downhill into paganism and murder and all sorts of terrible things. God did not make a covenant for the northern dynasty, nor has God made a covenant to America. Now, there were two or three contracts and covenants that some of the founding fathers, by that I mean those that came over on the Mayflower, they said, we dedicate this country and this colony to God, but that's not quite the same thing as these covenants they made with each other, but God has not promised to keep America a godly country, so we should pray, Lord, bring godliness to our country. And God holds all nations accountable, not just Israel, in America, all nations. Okay, verse 5. Obviously, we're not going to comment on every verse like in this series, but verse 5, it says, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord and had not turned aside from anything that he commanded him all his days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. That was his epitaph. You could put that on his tombstone. He did what was right, except for that one notorious. That doesn't mean he never sinned except with Bathsheba, but as a way of life, he was godly. Wouldn't you like to have something like that read out at your funeral or put on your tombstone, that you followed the Lord except for one blemish that kind of sticks with our reputation? Verse 6, the civil war continued for decades. Now, our civil war, 160 years ago, only lasted like 5 years, but other ones, you ever heard about the 100 years war over in Europe? 100 years. And other ones have gone on that long. Meanwhile, verse 7, and this is said after the death of so many of the kings, the rest of the acts of Abijam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Doesn't that sound like Revelation 20? The books were opened at the judgment day. God recorded everything about this king. God records everything about us, everything we think, say, do. And it'll be opened up one day. Verse 8, he dies, he's buried, and he goes to meet God. Well, what happens next? The second king we look at tonight is Asa. In the old days, Americans named their sons Asa. I've never met anybody in a long time. He was the son of Abijam, verses 8 and 9, and he succeeded him in the 20th year of Jeroboam's reign up north. Now, that's where it gets complicated, because it's not like they were electing on the same election year. They were fighting and taking over and dying young and dying old. And so to put them together is kind of like a plate of spaghetti or shuffling of the cards. But these are historical markers. From here on, it's not always easy to line them up. It's just like, I was hoping Jeff and Dina Rod were here. Jeff is from England, and he married an American girl, and they lived over there, and they've lived over here. If you were to ask Jeff, could you list all the American presidents and all the British prime ministers and kings and queens over there and put them in order, he'd say, that's quite a challenge. But that's what sometimes school kids like to do. Well, now I remember that Reagan was president, almost said king, when Queen Elizabeth was queen. She's been queen for over 65 years, but also in Margaret Thatcher, the longest serving British prime minister was in office. And then it's kind of gone back and forth, and occasionally someone comes back. It's sometimes difficult to sort out, but I won't go into that, but God knows it. And Asa, verse 10, reigned for 41 years. Think about that. It's longer than any United States president or British prime minister, but not as long as Queen Elizabeth, who set the record. And she's still on the throne as queen. And so what's Asa's epitaph? Verse 11, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Now look at that phrase. It's going to recur over and over again. He did right or he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And that just doesn't mean the Lord was watching. It means that good and evil is determined by how God sees it, not us. Remember that verse in Judges I quoted? Every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now that's like postmodern ethics we hear about. They say, well, there's no absolutes. What's good for you may be bad for me, and so let's all get along and don't. There's no absolutes. There are absolutes. God determines what is right and what is wrong. Now we come to a sordid verse, verse 12, which echoes something going back to Jeroboam a little bit earlier, verse 12. Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Verse 12, he banished the perverted persons from the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. There's a Hebrew word there that's talking about degenerate homosexuals, and he calls it perverted persons. These were more than just sexually immoral. They were part of the Canaanite religion, and they had, people would go to their temples and do these terrible things. So he was mixing immorality and pagan idolatry, and it's distasteful to even mention this, but it was far worse than fornication or adultery. This is something that's like there as bad as it can get, not just scraping the bottom of the barrel, but kicking the bottom of the barrel out. But Asa is praised for stopping it and banishing it. And it's called Perverted Persons. When was the last time you ever heard anybody on television, education, government, refer to homosexuals as perverts? When I was young, Vic, that was the common thing. There were other earthy terms that I won't repeat. They're saying they're perverts. It's unnatural what they're doing. Even animals don't do that. When was the last time you ever heard anybody call a spade what the Bible says, perverted persons? I still would use that term. Once, it was illegal in all 50 states with very severe penalties. And then gradually a few states, Massachusetts, California, legalized it. And then sadly, one of the saddest days in American history, the Supreme Court of the United States legalized it in all 50 states and threw out all the laws of those that had said it's wrong. That's kind of like Roe v. Wade, legalizing it everywhere. It should be totally illegal in America with the strictest of penalties. That's what Asa did, and I, for one, say that that should be done today. Not only that, this man is on a roll. Look at verse 13. He removed Ma'akah, his grandmother, from being queen mother. Now, the queen mother doesn't mean she's the queen. She's the mother of the king or the queen. Just like I remember the queen mother in Great Britain. She lived to be 101. She was the mother of Queen Elizabeth, but it was her husband that had been king. She was the queen mother. Believe me, the Brits know all about this language, but we Americans don't. So he knew that his grandmother was the queen mother, but she was very evil. Ma'akah, it says she had made an obscene image of Asherah, and Asa cut down this obscene image and burned it by the brook. Now, I'm not going to describe this obscene image. Archaeologists have found some of this, and their ancient tablets describe it. And the story was back in the 1920s when they came across a certain city that had been buried, and it was a Canaanite. When they dug it up and looked at these things, some of the archaeologists went outside and vomited. They said, how could it be so despicable? Ugh. And here's the queen mother promoting the worship of this pagan goddess, Asherah. Asherah was both the mother and the wife of Baal. That's how bad it was, and this was practiced in there. Now, some religions, they glorify this. Hinduism. You know, sometimes an American will save up and say, I'm going to go on a vacation over to India. And they go and they visit a Hindu temple and they see the pictures and the statues. And they're extremely gross. And they say, is this what Hinduism's all about? Yes, there are gods and goddesses. And that filters down to the common people. Well, Asa saw this and remembered that God had said the Canaanites are despicable. And so he says, I'm the king here in the southern kingdom. We're going to put a stop to this. Unfortunately, some people go to Hindu and they find artifacts and they buy them as souvenirs. And I've gone to seminaries that have some of the pagan statues and they put it behind glass and they say, you know, this, no, they should destroy it. And that's what happened when God sent revival, kind of a small revival with Asa. We should burn our idols like they did in the Bible. And yet he didn't carry it out completely, verse 14. But the high places were not removed. Nevertheless, Asa's heart was loyal, there's a word again, to the Lord in his days. What's special about these high places? It keeps coming up. These would be high hills, kind of like Indian mounds, where kind of like in the Tower of Babel, the higher we go up, then the closer we are to our gods and goddesses, and that's where they would do their ceremonies up there. I remember my late uncle down in South Texas would talk about a certain hill out there. And the American Indians from Oklahoma would go down there and they'd do their ceremonies. And they would do a sacrament that was later legalized by the Supreme Court. They'd find a little plant, there's a little cactus, and I still remember seeing hundreds of these. And they'd take the little buds off the top and eat them. Those buds produced mescaline. That's like a form of LSD. And then they'd go into these trances and dance around and do something. My Uncle Bubba used to say as a kid, we'd look at that and say, look at that, what are they doing? And it was crazy, but they'd do it on top of a hill. And that's what they did in Israel. They'd find a hill and build an altar and do the pagan worship up there. And Asa didn't get around to stopping that. Later kings would. And yet, it gives him this great epitaph. His heart was generally loyal to the Lord, just like David's. And now that verse 15, he restored some of the things that had been taken away, but they had been dedicated. Okay, now, king number 3, Baasha, verse 16. Meanwhile, back up north, the successor, or the first successor of Jeroboam, civil war still continued north and south, and I'm sure people up north and south were saying, will this ever end? Some of us remember the Vietnam War went on for, 10 years? Will it ever end? And it would continue on even after Baasha. So what he did was, verse 17, they had had these altars on the high places, but not a big temple, and some of the northerners would scoot across the border down south to go to Jerusalem where the temple was. There were no synagogues then, but they'd go down there, and Baasha said, we don't want that. They might stay. And so we need to do something up here. So he builds this town, Ramah, to prevent them from going across the border and saying, well, they can do their worship there, and they'll later build a temple. And so they built this and put guards to say, you can't come through, kind of like the Berlin Wall or the 38th parallel dividing North and South Korea. And there's a lesson there. He wanted to stop the northerners from going down south to worship in a biblical way. He wanted to keep them up north to keep them with the high places and the paganism. There are people today that want to build walls to keep sinners from coming to church or to worshiping in God's way, imitating Baasha. Okay, build this so they don't have to go down there. They don't have to go to church. They don't have to follow this old religion. We've got a new religion for you. You see, what goes around comes around. Verses 18 and 19, Asa took some silver and gold from the temple. And here's a weakness that comes out about him. He takes this money to the king of Syria, King Ben-Hadad, and he pays him to send some of his troops down in this civil war. You know, that happened in the American Revolutionary War. And boy, did this incense the American patriots. They said, the British, the Redcoats, they're hiring German mercenaries, to come over here and fight us. Boy, they didn't like that. But Asa did this. He bribed them. By the way, that is something old and it still goes on today. It's called foreign aid. We're sending billions of dollars to Ukraine to support them. I'm not taking sides. I'm saying that this is often what happens. They say, well, we'll pay you to help do the fighting. That's how the Vietnam War started. And then we started sending in troops. It happened in Afghanistan. We sent money to the Taliban. And then we said, well, you don't want the Taliban. So it happened in Iraq. And so then he realized, verse 19, that Ben-Hadad had made a treaty with Jeroboam, a mutual defense treaty. And so he says, break your treaty and side with us. Now, let's stop right there. This is not a political lecture, but should treaties always be honored? A treaty is a form of an oath and a vow. Should they always be kept? Think about that. What about contracts, wedding vows, other oaths and vows? Some oaths and vows are bad, should not be honored. Some treaties should not be honored, should never be done in the first place, and be bad to keep it. We find an example in the New Testament of a bad oath. You remember the 40 Jews that took an oath they're not going to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. Well, they never did kill Paul. It was a bad oath to make, a bad oath to try to honor. And there are some treaties that are like that. And a bad treaty should be annulled. But other ones are good and should be kept, just like a wedding vow or a contract or an oath in a vow in court. But what about mutual defense treaties like this? You ever heard of NATO? It's been in the news a lot with Ukraine, and then now was it Sweden and Finland are joining NATO, and it started off with just a handful of members. Now it's up to like 51. That's a mutual defense treaty. You attack us, you're attacking all of us. This last week I read a political commentator that said NATO is a good thing. We should also have NAPTO. Anybody ever heard of NAPTO? Sounds like something a baby does, you know, NAPTO, nap time. He said there should be North Atlantic Pacific Treaty Organization with guess who? Taiwan, and with South Korea. We already have a mutual defense treaty with. One of the most infamous ones goes back 70 years, CETO, S-E-A-T-O, Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. We had a treaty with South Vietnam, and that's why we had to send in troops for 10 years and lost, 56,000 of our people. Should these be honored? Should they be entered into? What about the United Nations? George Washington, our founding president, warned about foreign entanglements and said some mutual defense treaties should be made, but be very careful. Circumstances can change. The one you're agreeing to defend might turn out worse than your present enemy, so be very, very canny about that. Well, King Ben-Hadad agreed to it, verse 20. He changed alliances. He stopped supporting Jeroboam, and now he goes with someone else. Some people today, countries change alliances just for the money, just like some people. Oh, this is despicable in the business world. And if we had a successful businessman, he'd say this happens quite a bit. They sign a contract. A dozen lawyers say this is ironclad, but then they want to get out of that when they realize, uh-oh, and I want to change. And it goes to court, and they spend millions of dollars. In other words, they want to break a contract. It may have been a good contract in the beginning. They do it for the money, and they stab someone in the back financially. Meanwhile, verse 21, Baasha stopped building Ramah, because it was kind of like a standoff north and south. And then verse 22, Asa comes in and tears down Ramah, and he builds two other towns, Geba and Mizpah, to say, we don't want them from the north. We want them to come down here and bring their money and worship the God, but we don't want them to bring in their paganism. So he builds these new settlements, saying that'll be a step in the settlements. Does that sound familiar in Israel? It goes back to the 1920s, actually, after General Gordon in the 1917. Israel says, okay, we've got a treaty, and the Palestinians have this land, and then the Jews move in and build a settlement. They said, we're just building a few houses. They're putting in their stakes, and then the Palestinians say, you keep your settlements over in your land, and the fighting starts, and then the Palestinians cross the border and build settlements, and then the bombing back and forth. If you're Jewish, you know what you'd say? It just keeps going, just like back here in biblical days. Ah, but is America free of this? What about the American settlers moving west, taking land from the Indians? The settlers would move in. They'd say, okay, we had a treaty with the American Indians. We'll stay off their land, won't hunt their buffalo. And then settlers come in. They say, well, we don't have enough land, so we go into the land, and they break the treaty. Same thing here. They should have honored the treaty. Back to the text, verses 23 and 25. Late in life, now Asa becomes diseased in his feet, either lame or something like that, and then he dies. And it briefly mentions Jehoshaphat. We're going to say more about him later when we get to chapter 22. By the way, the Bible never calls him Jumping Jehoshaphat. You've heard that exclamatory term. There's nothing about him jumping. I don't know where that came from. Okay, we come to the fourth king tonight in verse 25, Nadab. Interesting. Why would someone name him Nadab? You remember another man, Nadab? Nadab and Abihu were the wicked sons of Aaron that offered strange fire, and they were burnt up. And now here someone says, I want to name my son after Nadab. That'd be like naming your son Judas. Tells you how bad it was. So he's another son of Jeroboam, and he starts reigning in the second year of Asa down south, but he only reigns for 2 years. His epitaph, verse 26, he did evil like his father. Like father, like son. Fathers need to realize you are the primary example for your sons to imitate. And they're going to more likely imitate your bad than your good. And so Nadab is imitating his father, who is very wicked, And he outdoes him, like father, like son, unless God intervenes. Verse 27, now the ongoing civil war in Baasha, an interesting pronunciation, conspires against Nadab and kills him. Probably not personally, but he hired an assassin. And that raises an interesting ethical question. Is assassination ever legitimatized? Now, before you answer, remember the assassinations in the book of Judges, where some of the judges were praised for assassinating an evil, murderous Philistine or Canaanite or whatever. Does that mean all of them are acceptable? No. What about hard cases? What about in World War II? Would it have been acceptable for us to send in commandos and assassinate Adolf Hitler? You bet. What about Hirohito? Where do you draw the line? It was time of war, and these were the leaders, therefore they were subject. People have said, what about Vladimir Putin? You remember President Biden let the cat out of the bag? He must not be allowed to stand. Was he saying go and assassinate him? Think about it. There were those that defended the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Would it have been acceptable in the Civil War to assassinate Jefferson Davis, the president of the South? They were soldiers. So yes, ask the question, why or why not? What does the Bible say? What principles apply? It's not as clear cut as you would think. Hard cases, yes, but other ones, it's not as clear cut. The reformers, Protestant reformers, addressed this and said it should not be the common people. It should be the lesser magistrates saying the king has become very evil. It's up to us, not the common people. It's up to us to remove him, even if that means putting him on trial and executing him. That was their judgment on that. And they said only in the most extreme cases. It's not always as clear cut, but that's what you see here and several times in the Bible. Meanwhile, we go back to the text. The rest of Jeroboam's family was killed off, and that was a custom. They said, kill them all off, lest anyone claim to be the next in line in the dynasty. And we're told this was in fulfillment of that prophet Ahijah's prophecy, that the line of Jeroboam would be cut off, and none of his descendants will later become king, unlike the covenant and the prophecies about David, his line. Chapter 6, verse 16, verse 1 kind of backtracks, going back in time, and says God had spoken to and through a prophet named Jehu. We'll hear about him more. And his prophecy against Baasha, and it was a grisly prophecy. You're going to die, and the dogs of the earth and the birds of the air are going to eat your corpses of your family members and your followers. And it came to pass. And of course, that would happen, we'll see next week, God willing, about Ahab and his wicked wife Jezebel. These were earthy terms and times. Okay, verses 5 and 6. Now Baasha dies, just like Jehu's prophecy. When God says something is going to happen, it's going to happen. And God says we will all die one day. Okay, king number 5 for tonight, Elah, a son of Baasha, and he becomes king of the northern tribes of Israel. He reigns for only 2 years. And he's killed, verses 9 and 10, by Zimri, who was one of the servants in the palace. And he only reigns for, 7 days? That's a short term. You ever done a study of how long American presidents reign? Who was the longest reigning one? They got to let the cat out of the bag. Well, FDR. But he didn't live out his fourth term. And after that, they passed an amendment. No president can serve more than 2 terms. Who was the longest reigning British prime minister? Margaret Thatcher. Did you know that? 12 or 13 years. The first one also reigned almost that long. The longest reigning British monarch was Queen Elizabeth. Be interesting, which the longest reigning British king? I'm not quite sure who it would be. But who was the shortest reigning or serving president? I wonder if anybody would know. Benjamin Harrison. During his extra long acceptance speech when it was snowing, he caught pneumonia and died after only 41 days in office. Shortest serving American president, and Zimri was president, or was king for only 7 days, and then he also is king. Because back then, there's backstabbing, and of course, this goes on in so many countries. You know, you get an alliance, and then they turn on you. But verses 11 and 12, Zimri had killed more of Baasha's family, according to Jehu's prophecy. So he was king number six, Zimri, very short reign. Now we come to our seventh and last king for tonight, Omri, verses 15 and 16. You know that a few years ago there was a well-known Welsh preacher named Omri. Omri Jenkins, very godly preacher. You don't hear the name Omri very much. Going back to Zimri, the people revolted against Zimri. Even the northerners didn't want him. So many of them sided with Omri. And some of the southerners, you know, kind of like divided loyalties. And so he burns the citadel. That would be the fortress around the palace, verses 18 and 19. And many people died in that. Verse 21, now the division amongst the people, are they going to follow Omri or this other fellow named Tibni? And they're in a tug of war. Now that Zimri's gone, it's like dogs fighting over a bone or thieves fighting over the loot. And so now they mention Samaria, verse 22. This is one of the very first recordings of Samaria, that area between north and south, not a demilitarized zone. It was still part of the north, and we'll learn more about that later. For example, after the exile, that's where Jews lived that intermarried with Canaanites and others in that area. And you've heard about the Good Samaritan, the woman at the well, Acts 8, when the apostles went into Samaria. Verse 25, what about Omri? What's his legacy? It says he was worse than all previous kings, north or south. It was like a race. How is he going to do worse than them? Now, that is an interesting question. Every now and then there's a poll taken. Who do you think is the best president or the worst president? Of course, it depends upon who you ask, and you look at the statistics and wonder if they're kind of greased to support one person or another. But I'd like to say, who do you think was the best president and why? Was it simply financial success and that we're on a roll, or was it godliness? You know, a lot of people said FDR was a great president, even though he presided during the Great Depression and World War II. And yet they still say he was a good president because he stopped it from getting worse and so forth. Why would we say someone is the best president? Why? By what standard do we measure them? Do we go by, what was that fellow's name years ago? I forgot his name. He was a friend of President Clinton, and he coined the little phrase, it's the economy, stupid. That's the bottom line. If you have success, then they're going to say you're a good president. That's not God's measure. God's measure is godliness. And so Omri, he ranks 10 out of 10 for being the worst thus far. He's buried in Samaria, which he had helped develop. You could say he dug his own grave, and that's what sinners do today. And who is he succeeded by? Tighten your seatbelt, Ahab. And he would outdo all of these put together, and we're going to look at him next week. Okay, here are four very quick lessons. Number one, kings and politicians go down in history like these as either heroes or villains. And you have to see it from God's perspective. How do we measure up ourselves by God's measure? A hero or a villain? Who do we resemble of these kings? Number two, only Abijam and Asa were good. These others, north and south, were bad. Lesson, according to the Bible, is the good are always outnumbered by the bad in society. Christians are always in the minority, even in times of revival. But better to be in the righteous minority than be in the evil majority. Righteousness is not determined by majority vote, but by God Almighty. Number three, and we'll see this in subsequent lessons. A godly parent can have an ungodly son or daughter. Look at this. Godly King Abijam, his son turns out bad. His son turns out good. What makes a difference? Well, it should be upbringing, but that's not the final say. The final say is God. Isn't it interesting that godly parents can have a very ungodly child that looked good when they were young, but boy, when they reach age, you know, age 18, 21, whatever, you say, what happened? But then on the other hand, some very ungodly parents can have godly children. God can intervene or God can take his hands off. Think about it. We see that illustrated here, and it will be for the next couple of hundred years. Fourthly and lastly, this is an example of what I preached on a few years ago, generational sins, the sins of the parents, particularly the father visited upon the children. And if the sins are passed on down, it takes a special work of God to reverse that. And parents should pray to God, don't let my sins be visited upon my children. Please, Father, please. And sometimes God lets a family go. And it gets bad and worse and worse and worse. We see that up north. But sometimes it's the other way around, where godly parents produce children that are even more godly and more godly, and it continues for a long time. I'll give you a very quick story. I have a photocopy of an old book in my library written about the year 1900, comparing the descendants of Jonathan Edwards and the descendants of one of the people that hated him, a man named Jukes. And so this genealogist traced whatever happened to Edwards's sons and so forth, and found out by and large they were upstanding citizens. Many of them were preachers, senators, judges, doctors. What about Jukes? Thieves, murderers, swindlers, smugglers. Generation sin, where God very rarely brought in godliness. And there was a couple of bad descendants of Edwards, but by and large, there's an interesting contrast. Had you ever heard that story? Very interesting. What about your descendants? We have a couple of children here. What about when they succeed us and they are old and gray? What about their grandchildren and great-grandchildren? We don't know. We should pray for them that are not even born yet and commit them to the Lord. Those are some of the lessons from what we've seen tonight with these seven kings. Let's pray and then we'll sing. Father, those were rough and rugged and ungodly days, and it continued and got worse. And yet you still raised up at least two godly kings that we looked at tonight, and we thank you for them. Our world is getting worse. Our country, as people say, is going to hell in a handbasket. But Lord, you still have your people. And you can still send revival to abolish homosexuality and idolatry and drugs. You've done it before. Send revival again, O Lord. And may it start with us. In the holy name of Christ our Lord. Amen.